Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Colby, for putting down getting the lights down a little bit. I was never one for a lot of bright lights, I'll tell you. One of my favorite bars was called the Bastille down in the French Quarter, Nolens, and we could spend 48 hours in there and just, you know, I was working as a bartender and I have 2 days off and I'd spend my whole time off in the bar and then I would just walk back down the street to the Lamplighter and go to work 2 days later. But, you know, you could, dark bar, and people would come in and the whole quest was not to open the door after the sun came up, you know, just to keep the door closed until the sun went back down and not let anybody in. It was a bunch of vampires. But brightness was never my thing, so thanks for getting those lights down. I want to thank everybody for coming and the people that asked me to come, and Diane and Puffy and Steve, and I sponsor some girls in this room, and there's a gentleman, Jim, saw me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the women I sponsor women in this room, and I've got friends in this room, and sober brothers of babies I sponsor, and so I feel pretty safe, and, you know, I they're all going to report, so be kind. But I just want to just tell you that it's just such a joy to be with you, and to celebrate the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're coming up on the birthday in a few days, and I always think about it. I have this medal I carry around. It's a Matt Talbot medal that was given to me by a priest in Australia. And Matt Talbot, they're signing petitions for the canonization of Matt Talbot as a saint because he's kind of the patron saint of the alcoholics. And he was born in a time and frame where there wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, just that we have the privilege of walking down the street and going to a meeting, and if you don't like that one, you can open a directory and go to another one, probably the same, within the same hour or two. I mean, it's such a blessing that we are born in a time and frame if you're an alcoholic. Because Matt Talbot wasn't. And what he would do when he would feel the craving come on was he would have his buddies chain him to a tree, you know, so that he could work through the 24 hours, 48 hours of craving. Whatever the craving was, they would chain him to a tree. And then he got so into it that he would walk around with these chains on, and he had chains embedded in his skin when he died and when he was buried. And I think of that. I think, you know, go ahead and complain a little, but it's a lot better. I can just see you chained to a tree, you know. It's the easier, softer way, Alcoholics Anonymous, believe me. So if you're in the room, you know, that's the gift. And I want to welcome the new people. I know there's a few here. I want you to know that, you know, that is the gift that has been given to you, and you can't deny it, the gift of knowing if you're an alcoholic, knowing there's a way to go, called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, what you do with this special, precious gift that's been given to you is, it's up to you. On page 25, it talks about the spiritual tools laid at your feet, and you have to pick them up and use them. People around here showed me how to use them, and I was such a good manipulator. I remember being in a home ec class. We had to take home ec when I was growing up, and I always wanted to hang out and shop with the boys, but I had to take home ec, and I would go home and ask my mother, okay, now how do you do this, Mom? And then she would show me, okay, now how do you do this, Mom? And I mean, you know, I never learned how to put together a sewing machine needle and all that because my mom, I manipulated her. She put in the zippers, she put in the buttons, she put in the pot. I would just sit there and manipulate my mother all night long to make something. And I did that with life. It's just an analogy of how I was with life. I would manipulate you to do the work for me, and I would sit back and enjoy the goods, enjoy the end result of what you had done. And when Alcoholics Anonymous blessedly came into my life, nobody said, here, let me do it for you. Let me work step one for you, Sharon. Let me go take third step. You'll just get the benefits. They said, you've got to do the work. So I hope you take the steps, and I hope that you know that at the end, that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that's promised if you take the steps, that that you get your own experience with it. And that's the joy of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know it's here now, and your experience is what you want. Grab it. Fasten your seatbelt. I grew up in Iowa, and that was definitely my first resentment. And I wanted to be a California girl. I just wanted to be a California girl. And what happened for me was, 13 years old, I discovered what alcohol would do for me. What alcohol would do for me was something that nothing had done for me before then. All the security of my family, all the love, all the kindness, all the, you know, the religion, all everything that I had in my favor. You know, I was artistic, I was musically inclined. It didn't fill me up like alcohol filled me up. It was a spiritual experience for me. I was lacking in spirit, and I found it in alcohol. It filled me up. It allowed me to relax. It allowed me to become from a flat-chested, skinny, knock-kneed little girl sitting on that 57 Chevy, slide off and become Marilyn Monroe, all in the, 5 minutes of Schlitz beer and Canadian Club. And it allowed me to come out. It just, my head was so loud always with what I should do, what I shouldn't do. You know, Steve talked about it last night, and Scott's going to talk about it tonight, and Clara's going to talk about it tomorrow. And you probably identify with that loud head. Loud, 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 loud head. And I just think I get them figured out in my life, you know, and then they change clothes in the middle of the night, and I don't know who's on whose side anymore. And so I just do what my sponsor says. I kind of turn it down like a bad radio station, you know. But I always had a loud head, and alcohol got me quiet. Alcohol got me focused. Alcohol gave me courage. Alcohol made me bulletproof. Alcohol allowed me to tell you what I think. Alcohol allowed me to become who I wanted to become. Alcohol was spiritual. It filled me up from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes. It was good stuff, and I got it as much as I could and made it happen. And I come from a non-alcoholic family. I'm still waiting. There's nobody. I had a cousin. He went off to the service, and he got straightened out. I was hoping. You know, he had one drunk driving, but that was 10 years ago now. It's like, you know, lightweight. So nobody in my family knew what was going on with me, and I was a really good manipulator, and I was able to get out of those scrapes by the hair of my chinny chin 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 and talk my way out or cry my way out. And I went off to college, and it was the 60s. It was just, you know, just say thanks, not just say no. We had a lot of fun with our alcohol. We took a lot of stuff. I was on a search for truth. This nice little sorority-clad, you know, matching Bobby Brooks sweater, skirt, patent leather purse, matching her patent leather purse, you know, shoes. Went off to Washington, D.C. to the citizenship thing I won. They picked two people out of every state, a male and a female. It was a contest, and I won, and I got to go to the White House and have tea, and I was drunk having tea at the White House. I had met the boys from Virginia. You know, a year or two later, I am marching on Washington for peace and freedom and angry. I'm so angry. I'm so angry now. I'm looking at all the hypocrisies in the world. And in 2 years' time, I turned from somebody that had a lot of hope and a lot of vision and a lot of chance into somebody that was blaming you, building my list, making, you know, building my case, pushing you away, fighting with everybody and anything in my life that was trying to help me and love me and care about me. Spitting in God's face and just marching alone. I mean, I don't care if I was with 100,000 people, I was alone. I was always alone until I came to you. That's kind of a hallmark of our disease. I was inside, I could find the sickest person in the room. I don't know what it was. I was like a sick person magnet. I could get all dressed up and look really nice, and the sickest one in the room could always find me. I don't know how they did that. I know that there were a lot of things in my life, people that would find me and say, you need help, and I do. I do need help. I mean, the Laguna Beach Jesus freaks, I mean, they baptized down in the 70s down in Laguna Beach, and I ended up down there. I was going to become a surfer girl, and I ended up working at the Sawdust Festival, working for a speed freak who painted pictures really fast in the back room. And he would have me sit there with all my, you know, petticoat clothes on and my little halter tops that were made out of leather and the bells around my ankles and my, you know, little symbols, finger symbols, and I drink my wine, and I put flowers in my hair, burn my incense, and sell all his little pictures. And he loved me. All he wanted to do was give me wine. That's all I wanted was wine. You know, he would paint those. He would just take some more speed and paint some more pictures. And I came to California with, you know, a quarter in my pocket. I had, you know, I had taken a lot of geographics by that time in my life. I was 21, and those Jesus freaks found me, and they said, "You look like you need something." I was like, "Yeah, I do. What do you got?" You know, and they had something. But when they said they wanted me for eternity, they wanted, you know, my spirit or soul for eternity, I went, "I just live a day at a time. Excuse me, I'm pick up my backpack and see, look at this book in my backpack. It was Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass, you know. I'm loving the one you're with and being here now. And I don't know how to make a commitment, and I don't know how to do anything for eternity or forever. So, see ya. You know, and I turned 21 dancing with the Krishnas in Westwood, and they wanted me, and they wanted a commitment out of me, and they wanted to change my name. And no, I live a day at a time. See, look at Be Here Now, love the one you're with, you know, dog at my heels, wind at my back. It was a lot easier. It was a lot easier. And by that time of my life, by the time I was 21 years old, I had blown through any sort of art talent I had. It was dead and gone. I had lived in New York for a while. I'd lived in Colorado for a while. I had met Bob Dylan, traveled with him to California. I think it was Bob Dylan. Anyway, it sang like Bob. He sang like Bob. The summer I was missing, so it could have been. But I had broken my father's heart. I had had a huge fight with the priest. I had him so mad at me, he came out of the confessional. We were screaming at each other. See, and I could justify it. Look at this man, you know, with the vows he's taken. And I would push your buttons until you just came at me, and then I would turn it around and go, "Look what you're all about. You think I want what you've got? Forget it." I just would prove you wrong. That was my job in life, was to look at the negative side and prove you wrong. But when I drank alcohol, I didn't need anybody or anything. You know, whatever was going on at the moment, I was complete. And when alcohol worked for me, that's what it did for me. I was complete. And the rest of the time, when I was chasing that feeling, I don't know if it would happen on the second shot of tequila or I'd have to drink the whole quart. I had an insatiable thirst for drinking, and, you know, I did all the other things to find truth and to keep me up so I wouldn't miss truth, and, you know, and I never understood anybody face down going, "Let's party." I was one of those, "Let's get up and go and move for 4 or 5 days, and then when the sun comes up finally," you know. I just thought it was that big light going off and on. "Oh, it's the sun. Oh, okay." Maybe I'd come to in Texas and we'd start life over again. I really didn't have any ties that meant anything to me because they hurt too much. Making commitments hurt too much. Having people in your life that loved you hurt too much because I was unlovable by now. I had been through a lot of situations in life where I had moved that line in the sand. Only with myself. You talked about last night, you know, alcoholism isn't a moral thing. You know, it's not, if you suffer from the disease of alcoholism, our natural state is to be drinking. You know, it's an absolute gift that we have sobriety, and abstinence is the archway to it. You know, so my life when I was drinking was lonely and sad, and I had to constantly be the victim. I was angry. I kept you away. And I just became less and less of a human being. It took more for me to get to the edge, to see what was happening over the edge, because I like to walk to the edge, you know. And a lot of people that go to the edge don't get to come back. And that's, you know, those are the ghosts of the people that I remember in my drinking and the people in sobriety that have had to go over and look over that edge one more time, and they just fall off. They don't get to come back. So, you know, I was 21 living back at home with my mother and father, and it was not what they had planned for daughter number two. And I met somebody who said he'd take care of me, and so I ended up at an organic farm doing organic living, eating organic food, doing my chapter three. And they took away my alcohol. They gave me organic pot to smoke, and that's what I smoke morning to night. And every once in a while, though, I would just get so thirsty, and I'd go put my, I painted mailboxes, so, you know, I'd get my quarters together and go get some cheap wine and come home, and, you know, I just felt better knowing that the wine was right there on the table, and they would go off to bed, and I would crack open the wine, and I'd start to party, me and the dog and the cat, and because nobody wanted to party with me. They were normal. They liked smoking their pot, drinking a little bit of their organic wine, eating their organic food, raising their organic animals and their organic vegetables and the organic honeybees and the organic trees we tap for maple syrup. And it was a lot of work. All I was just like, oh, it's not my idea. Yeah. Eventually, they went off to spend all their money on primal therapy, and I just decided to go drink and scream at the sheep, and I had my own primal going on in the barn. And my friend Clarence the farmer would come, and he was on the tractor. I'd hear the tractor rounding the lane. I know he bought some hard stuff. Oh, good, Clarence is coming tonight. Maybe he's bringing the bourbon, the vodka, whatever, you know, to go along with my cheap wine. And Clarence would come, and, you know, some nights he'd put in his teeth, and some nights he wouldn't put in his teeth. But we would get drunk, and he was my pal. And the reason he's on the tractor, his license had been pulled for too many DWIs, so he was on the tractor. And then his wife took away the keys to the tractor, and never saw Clarence again. And I have this half acre of pot I had been growing, organic pot, of course, organic seed with organic sheep dung in the soil. It was a lot of work, but it was worth it. And I would live out there all summer. And I set up this pot deal. I forgot the pot, and I joined the carnival, and it was that simple. I wasn't making really good decisions in my life about now. I called my mother from Arkansas, and she just started to cry. And I thought, oh, God, Mom. You know, my father and I hadn't sat down and had a meal together now for a couple of years. I would come home, and my dad would kind of give me one of those sideways looks with that tight jaw. Like, he couldn't look at me because it just hurt too much. Or I would shoot him one of those looks like, you know what, why don't you fix it? You know, I dare him to fix it. And I was Daddy's little girl. Daddy played an accordion, and I played an accordion because I wanted his attention. I grew up in this state, like I said, Iowa, where they celebrate anything. You know, if the town's 100 years old, they have this big parade, and we would sit on these hay wagons and on these bales of hay, and I would have my Titano accordion out there, this mother of pearl and black, beautiful accordion, and we would all wear, as part of Mrs. Boddicker's accordion band, and we would wear these red dresses and this black, and we would look just also American sitting out there on the hay wagon, and we would be playing, and I'd see my father, and he would just beam, you know, and then I would see the boys from Solon from the night before, and I'd have to kind of slink around to see what a cornball I was, you know, but I love my father, and now when I walked in the room, we couldn't even look each other in the eye anymore. I mean, my dad had tried to help me. He had brought the priest, the psychiatrist. He had done a lot. He took me to the family doctor. Nobody knew alcoholism in my family. Nobody knew what was wrong with me. She could just get off those drugs and meet a nice guy and maybe go back to school. She would be such a good teacher. But now my dad and I, you know, now it's with my mom. My mom cries when I call home, and I just thought, oh, it just hurt too much, the call home. I ended up with this carnival, working my way south. I was a shooting gallery girl, and I would start fights on the midway. They would get it closed down. The owner of the show would get mad at me. I was drinking tequila. Even my nice dog was biting people now. It was, you know, my mouth had slipped to the side. The cowboy boots are on, and you know, everything I owned would sit in that car named Cheshire, because if you name those $50 cars, they last longer, you know. And I painted a big sun on the hood. It had bald tires, but we were with the show. We were with the show. And somewhere down in Louisiana, I got us closed down one more time, and somebody must have fingered me, and they knocked at the door at 6 a.m., and it was the parish finest in that part of the world, Bogalusa, Louisiana. And, you know, they stuck a shotgun in my belly and made me stand there with no clothes on. They searched the room, and they found everything they needed, and it was enough for a felony. It was possession and sales, and I said, I'm not selling. This is my personal stuff, you know, but it was enough that they thought I was selling. So Carnival left town and I went off to jail. And that was something I had avoided, was getting locked up. But now I couldn't get out of this one. And after about a week in there, they took me to this building, and there was a office and a chair, and they threw me in the room, and I'm handcuffed, and I'm a mess, and I don't know how to do lockup very well, and I was pretty crazy. And they threw me in there, and there was my dad sitting there, and my father had gotten word of what had happened, and he had come down to try to help me get out of this. And I remember sitting next to my father that day, and I don't remember much else other than we didn't hug and we didn't touch and he didn't say, "I'm sorry, what is wrong with you? Maybe you're an alcoholic, Sharon." I mean, nobody knew. And about 8 years ago, I asked my father about that day. It's, you know, you don't go running out in your first year of sobriety and go, "Gee, let me bring up all these situations that were painful, because I need to know." So it took me until 8 years ago to ask my father about that day, because I didn't remember much, and I wanted to know a little bit more. He said, "You told me you weren't guilty. That's all you told me. It's not my fault." It was never my fault. And that was my M.O., you know. I had a list a mile long as to why my life was the way it was. And I went back to jail, and my dad hired this lawyer, and he ended up, you know, taking a lot of money from my father and not doing anything, and I ended up paying a big fine, and I met my probation officer in the bars in the French Quarter, and I was a convicted felon now. So there was something there that I hadn't planned on. And I found the French Quarter, and I drank with abandon, just wonderful abandon, wonderful abandon. That was such a great city for an alcoholic. I found everybody. I found all of you. You know, we all protected one another. If there was something going on, you know, people would throw me in a cab, and I would see the cab driver a couple days later, and I'd pay him. I mean, we just all took care of each other. I danced on Bourbon Street. I wore platinum blonde wigs, fishnet stockings, little zippers on all my outfits, and I had a pet skunk, and we'd go down Bourbon Street together to work. And the skunk was, his name was Crank, and he had a little silver collar with little rhinestones, and we would go out drinking afterwards. And the skunk liked rum and coke, and he liked the maraschino cherry, and he would lay on his back drunk, and then soon after that I would be laying next to the skunk drunk, you know, whoever came to first would wake the other one up to move on. And I had met this guy in the carnival, and you know, I had a dog, and then we got a snake, and we lived above a biker bar, and it just got crazier and crazier and crazier. And my parents went to Texas and came over and found me, and to make sure I was still alive, because I hadn't called home in a while, because I stopped Christmas and birthdays and Easter, and you know, it didn't matter anymore. It didn't matter. It hurt too much to call home. It hurt too much to find out how everybody else was doing. I just quit faking it. I quit telling them, "Yeah, things are great, and you know, you should see the sun." And I remember coming to California and telling how great it was, and all the cars and all the people. And the last time I came to California, I'm homeless, I'm unemployable, I'm wearing a red dashiki Panama hat, I'm walking Sunset Boulevard, and I don't even remember much of it. And I wrote a letter to my friend in the French Quarter, Robin, and she gave me that letter about 6 years ago. And you would have thought my life was together by that sad, sorry letter. I mean, it was all lies. It was all lies. I was sleeping in hallways. I was sleeping in alleyways. I was sleeping, if somebody had a spare room, they'd let me stay there. I had become unemployable. My brain wasn't working. I couldn't remember where the drinks went as a cocktail waitress, and they asked me to leave, and I couldn't get another job. It was over for me. I was 25 years old, and it was over for me. But that letter that I wrote to Robin in the French Quarter, you would have thought that I was starting all over again. It was such a lie. But with my parents, I just stopped calling home. And so they found me living in this situation with this black eye. And my mother cried, and my father couldn't look at me. And when they went home that day, I knew something was deathly wrong with me. I knew that it was over. I knew that soon I was going to, you know, be laid out and be a picture framed in black on my parents' piano. And they would go, "God, you know, she had such talent. We don't know what happened to her." And nobody knew alcoholism. And I felt like I felt guilty and like the big loser. And I wasn't even human anymore. I mean, I didn't look in the mirror to part my hair. I remember at the last of my drinking, I remember when water hurt, and I guess I had stopped bathing. It wasn't fun anymore. And there were times when alcohol would work, and there were times that I seemed to be having DTs. I had had my gallbladder removed. I had pancreatitis, and I was physically very sick. And that was in 1975. And I saw the Big Book in a bar called Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood. And the girl that was going to an A&A meeting out of that bar, drunk as drunk could be, had that black and white book under her arm. And I thought, I was embarrassed for her. I thought she could at least turn the cover around, you know. She's walking. But we all took a drink and toasted her out the door. And the bartender called her a taxi because he didn't want her to drive. He thought maybe she would get in a wreck. And that was the first time I had ever heard Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came back to New Orleans, and I had more DTs, and I had that speaking paralysis, and it seemed like my friends didn't even want to be with me anymore. And I had left town about 2 months prior because my friend Michael had been shot and killed, and he was 2 feet to my left, Mardi Gras Day. And Michael was just like us. Michael deserved to be here. Michael had one of those moments in a blackout where he leveled a gun at a policeman and the policeman killed him, and I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout. When I came to, my friend was dead. And Norm Alpe, who was mentioned last night, who was a wonderful, exciting member of Alcoholics Anonymous, used to talk about seconds and inches, and I knew what he meant. You know, if 2 feet to the left, you'd have another speaker. And we all have them. You know, every single one of us have those seconds and inches that we have somehow, by the coming together, by the confluence of different happenings in our life, brought us to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And not every alcoholic gets here. And that's the blessing. But it's just by seconds and inches, because on that day that I came to you, I wasn't looking for sobriety. I didn't know it was going to be my sobriety date. I didn't really know I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just the coming together of my surrender. It was my moment in time. And what happened was, after I left the French Quarter, I was going to Hawaii, and I ended up in that bar again. And this is when I was walking Sunset, and I was unemployable, and I ended up going to Palm Springs on a Harley. I like bikes. I like tequila. I'm not one of those long-term comfort people. I like instant gratification. I want it now. So I liked things that were loud, things that were boisterous. Plus, it was the only way I seemed to be able to feel anymore. You know, I needed a lot to be able to feel. I remember sitting in a bar and having absolutely no feelings for my good friends sitting over there getting beat up. I remember thinking, what is wrong with you? I just didn't care. Every piece of my heart was either loaded or just stone cold by that time of my life. And alcohol will take every piece of you, but I would give it willingly. I gave my love of God. I gave my wanting to do something for humanity, which was a real calling for me when I was a little girl. I gave my musical ability. I gave my artistic ability. I gave my love of family. I gave my worth as a woman and a human being. And I don't know if the bartender in any of these times that I was giving it up would have said, excuse me, that's the last of your dignity here. You sure you want to pay with that? I would go, absolutely, you double it and you buy him one too. Take my dignity. Give me my alcohol. It talks about King Alcohol in the Big Book. King Alcohol, king over everything. Everything. Alcohol, I laid my soul out there for alcohol. Absolutely. It was powerful. And for me to get to a point of surrender and willingness and wave a white flag in my life is just a moment in time. A moment in time. And I ended up at this nightclub, and the guys on the bike said, bye-bye, we just need a little extra weight. Thank you for your, you know, 170-plus pounds on the back of the bike. It was windy going through the desert. And they left me, and I guess I met some people and made them mad, and they took me somewhere, and I couldn't cry my way out of this one. I couldn't beg my way out of this one. I couldn't bargain my way out of this one. I got my jaw broken in 3 places and my nose broken and physically abused and sexually abused and thrown off the side of the road. And it was July 27th in the desert, 1975. And I should have just baked. I had a concussion and I was bleeding from my broken jaw. And I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. I paid attention to it. I heard it. It woke me up. It made me lift my hand, my head up off the sand. And I ended up being found by a gardener, and they called, I guess. And next time I came to, I am lying on a gurney in the hospital. And that voice came back. It said, you know what? Your dad didn't put you on this gurney. And it's not George who broke your heart at 18. It's not your sister, the Mensa, you had to follow through life. Yeah. That Catholic Church and all its hypocrisy that I was always, you know, bleeding deacon about. Your father and, you know, these guys. These guys just did what you wanted. You did this to you. Boy, I don't want to hear that. I'm finally getting a piece of truth and I can't handle it. And then I don't remember much. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks in intensive care for a week and then in regular room for a week. And I got some cards in the mail, but no money. For the first time in my life, nobody sent me an airline ticket. See, it's like I'm being really set up to come to you. And I drank in places where I didn't share my feelings. You know, people didn't say, gee, how are you today? And I went, I'm feeling a little sensitive today, you know. It's always, what's it to you, you know. Those were the type of bars I loved to drink in. So I wasn't into sharing my feelings, but here I was in a situation where it was all laid out for me. There was no place to go. There was no money. I was their victim, and they sent me off in the world with this wired jaw and this nose that was all taped up, and I was so black and blue they didn't know I was Caucasian when they found me. It took a long time for the bruises to go away. And I ended up above this liquor store in West Los Angeles where a guy was buying me red wine, and I would stick a straw into the cheap red wine and through the wires where the tooth had been, and I would suck on red wine because I'm on a liquid diet. I'm a diehard alcoholic. All I know to do is to drink. I don't care if you take away my mouth. I'll figure out a way to get it in there. And I called my mother because this guy said I had to leave. I was depressing him. I called my mother. Now, this is another seconds and inches for me because my mother had known something had happened to her daughter, and she didn't know what hospital I was in. And it took my sister in New York and my mother in Iowa 2 days to find me, to find out I was going to be okay. So for 2 nights, my mother didn't sleep. She worried about her daughter. And when I called her, I am a mother. I don't know how she got these words because she's never been to Al-Anon. She wasn't waiting for me to call. So she didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just said, Mom. I said, Mom, because I couldn't talk. told her I needed some money. She says, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And if Mom would have sent just $20, you'd have another speaker. It was seconds and inches. And I looked down in front of me, and there was a phone number. I called, and it was that girl in the bar with the big book. Could have been turned upside down, and you'd have another speaker. But I called her, and she recognized alcoholism. And that was August 20th, 1975. And I haven't had a drink or a hit or a snort or a toke or anything since that day. And I had no idea. No idea. But I called Chris, and Chris said, well, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. And Chris wasn't sober that day, so she knew she really couldn't 12-step me. She'd been in and out of AA a number of times by this date. And when I saw her was about a year later. I got to tell her thank you, but she didn't remember me. She was in a hospital program, drooling on herself in a wheelchair when I saw her, and she was 31 years old when she died of alcoholism. And I don't know if God would have told her, you know, Chris, you only have 7 times in and out of the doors here, not 8, if she could have hung on that 7th time for the life that I know is possible for us alcoholics with Alcoholics Anonymous. And but she got me to Suzanne, and Suzanne was a 5-year sober member of my home group. And Suzanne said, don't drink anything and don't smoke anything either. And I put my joint down like she knew what I was talking about. Like, oh, God. And you know, we're going to send someone to get you. And I don't know where, get me. I don't know where I'm going, you know. And so I sat on the steps of that liquor store, and this car pulled up, and it was bright yellow, and there were 2 bright girls in it with bright hair and bright eyes and bright teeth, and they were real happy to see me, and I just got up and went with them, and every inch of me is going, no, 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 no. I'm not going with them. I don't like them, you know. And they put me in the back of this car where you can't get out. You can't move. Those Volkswagens have no windows that roll down, and it seemed like they talked incessantly about themselves. Nobody asked me about me. I was waiting, you know. I heard somebody say, God, look at her. She looks surrendered. Maybe she'll make it. They were happy I was hurting. I went to this church, and I thought, oh, here we go. I'm going to have to say I don't do forever. I do a day at a time. And we walked up to the door, and this man was the greeter, much like your greeters here. You know, they're all, like, bright-eyed and, Tony, watch out, you know. They come get you. And he put out his hand, and I thought he was going to whisk me in the kitchen behind him, and what he said was, welcome. I thought he was going to say, you look terrible. You can't come sit with the people. You got to go sit in the kitchen until you clean up. And he didn't. He just said, welcome. Where am I and what are these people doing and what do they want? You know, like I have a lot to give, you know. They sat me at a table. They raised my hand. I didn't know what that's about. Some man walked over and gave me a big book, which was this Alcoholics Anonymous book. And I gave him my last quarter because that's all he had. And I didn't hear the payment terms thing, but I didn't want to owe you anything. And some man from the podium said he waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. And I knew he knew how I felt. And I want to say one thing because I'm sure Scott will talk about his sponsor, Paul, too. For years, I had a resentment against Dr. Paul because people talk about page 449, page 449, page 449. And I would be all stressed out and someone would say, go home and read page 449. Well, I had the second edition, which is the black, and that was mine. I'd go home and read it, and it was a story called Joe's Woes. And it wasn't the acceptance that's in, you know, the third edition, the big book. So I would go home for years. I didn't tell anybody that I wasn't getting it. Because I thought if I told you I didn't get it, you'd kick me out of here, you know. And then I got a third edition big book, and I was like, oh, thank God. Sir, if you're new, ask a lot of questions. It's okay if you don't get it. You know, we don't expect you to get it. And that's the time to ask, is when you're new. Ask a lot of questions. So, but I got this book, and then I got a sponsor because they made me. It's just, I didn't know where I was. They said, don't drink and use. We'll pick you up tomorrow night. So I wouldn't drink and use, and they picked me up, and then they moved me out, and they sat there and waited for the liquor store lights to turn off before they sent me upstairs. And you know, in retrospect, I was absolutely getting Alcoholics Anonymous, the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, in actions. These girls didn't know me. They didn't know a thing about me. They just were trying to give me a chance by sharing with me. And they were sitting there in a hot car with a detoxing, smelling alcoholic, waiting for the liquor store's lights to turn off so that they can send me upstairs so they can come pick me up for a noon meeting tomorrow and pick me up for a night meeting tomorrow night. Just don't drink and use in between and we'll pick you up. And that's all I heard, you know. And all of a sudden I realized I had 30 days of sobriety. And I didn't know where it came from. I was 31 days, I didn't raise my hand. It was like, oh my God, how did that happen? I used to beat my fist on the bar to get a drink faster. I knew I had it made when my favorite bartender at Marley's Irish Pub would slide that rock glass of gold over to me. You know, just it would just almost tip out the top, but it was that tequila would just kind of come across the bar and my piano player would break into my song. It was a great victim song, You Made Me Love You. I knew I had it made, you know, that as an alcoholic. I didn't wait for a drink, and here I was, 31 days sober. It was like a moment in time when, you know, all the hair kind of stood up in the back of my neck. I just felt a power. For a moment, just a second. You know, I grew up in Iowa where they do a lot of planting, and I know they do up here, and it's all well thought out, and they have to have the soil just so, and they have to fix things just right so that we get, you know, the best crops. And every once in a while, when I go home for the summer, I'll be driving along, and it just looks all beautiful and green, and then out of the corner of my eye, I'll catch a glimpse of it, how it's all laid out in rows. And that's kind of how it felt. For just a moment, I had a glimpse of a power. And I felt it, and I thought, how did this happen? And I, you know, I love what Steve talked about last night, too, because right before I got a year of sobriety, it was just like, I better go have my slip. You know, I'm going to be here forever if I don't go have my slip, and I'm going to learn a lot on my slip because I'm hearing everybody talk about, God, I'm so glad I had my slip. I learned this, and that's all I heard was the slip stuff. And my sponsor, luckily, I had a sponsor, and I've always had one louder than my own head. So I hope you get a sponsor louder than your head. She said to me, you're only hearing the ones that come back, Sharon. I was like, oh, yeah, what happened to Mike? And what happened to... So, you know, my head was always loud. And I'm so glad I got this sponsor, half Mexican, half Indian. Jim knew her. She said she had a hip shorter than, you know, one of the hips was shorter. So when she'd walk in a room, you know, all the men would look because she just had the greatest little waddle. And she laughed like a duck, and I would sink in the seat, and she'd quack, 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 oh, that's my sponsor. Why did I pick her? And she'd wear all these fluorescent things and these big nails, and she was short and little, but either she's quacking or she's glowing. I could always find her in the room. And Janet was on to me. Janet was on to me. She was so great. I mean, I remember calling her thinking, how do you know? And and I used to eat apples in the phone to her. I used to just, because I'm a rebel. I'll probably always be a rebel. I'm one for the underdog. I'll seek out the person that nobody's talking to. I'm always like, I mean, I'm just a rebel. And Janet was too. And so she was on to me. And then I got to sponsor another rebel when I was newly sober. And she, one day I heard this crunching on the phone. I said, what are you eating? She said, yeah, I'm eating carrots, you know, crunching in the phone. I said, and I bet from time to time you hold the phone out at arm's length, don't you, when I'm talking? She said, how do you know? I used to do that. So be nice, because it'll repeat. Remember that. Whatever you do to your sponsor, you're going to get back. Janet was great for me. And Janet, we worked the first three steps together, and the third step, I just did a third step with Jerry today. And I always, it's much more exciting for the sponsor than it is for the baby. I think they're kind of like, okay, what is this all about? But, you know, and we hugged, and she, you know, we're at her house, and her kids were home, and the drapes were open, and the sun was out, and we're on our knees, and now we're up, and we're hugging, and we're reading this thing, and she won't stop hugging me, and, you know, then it feels good, and I think I'm gay. I mean, that's the whole thing of it. And I have to sit down with her and discuss not making any major decisions in my first year, and... You know, and Janet was just so great for me. I remember I almost got drunk over the color of a car. You know, in retrospect, I think, God, that would be sad. You know, she was great, but then she went and got her car painted Basin Street blue and didn't like the color, and she had to go have a drink. You know, it's like, the car is gone, you know. I mean, it's like, those are just things. And but I went to work with my waitress uniform on and that car that was bright, bright, bright turquoise. Back in, you know, the 70s when nothing was bright like that. And I had to put a chair behind the driver's seat or I was really low riding because the seat was broken. It was my first car, though. I got car insurance. I got my driver's license in my own name. And then I go get it painted this Basin Street blue color. And I showed them the color and they said, well, that's faded. And I was like, oh, my God. So I went to work and I was the bar or the restaurant. Let me call her. I'm going to call that woman first and just tell her that they're abusing me. The world is. And she had me laughing, you know, in the matter of 30 seconds, she had me laughing. Laughter is the only first real feeling I had here. I was real numb. I didn't know, you know, am I hungry or happy? Am I angry or, you know, am I tired? I just didn't know. I needed a sponsor to put my circuits together. I was really used up. And that's the best time to get in a relationship, right? I mean... I met him. He had 6 more months than me and he knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous. He treated me nice. He bought me flowers. And we went home to make amends to my father and meet my dad and talk to my family and try to be a good daughter. And they liked him and he liked them. And I was a little over a year sober and I was putting the bags in the car to come back to L.A. And I knew I had to make those amends to my dad because a sponsor will kill me. You know, I was a little intimidated by her, thank God. And I made those amends to my dad standing by the car, leaning against the hot car on a hot September afternoon. And I remember looking down at the sand and making holes in the sand with my toes because I couldn't look up at him. And my dad, you know, my dad was looking down too. And nobody healed and the angels didn't sing. And it wasn't this big coming together, but it was a start. I was willing to make those amends. It was willingness. And he just said he always wanted me to be happy. And that was it. It was that simple. And I was able to start with my amends to my family and my amends to a lot of the people on my list and those people in New Orleans. And I went back for the International Convention in 1980 and got to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just with what you had done with me physically, those people were amazed. They were drunk, but they were amazed. And two of those women that I was very close to are sober today, and that is a joy, and I get to sponsor one of them. And the other one went back to law school, and a couple of years ago sent me a piece of paper in the mail, and I'm a fully pardoned ex-felon from the state of Louisiana, and that was a gift because of Alcoholics Anonymous, something I didn't think I could get or want or deserved, or it just came as a total gift because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood up a little straighter and taller that day. I've spent a lot of years cleaning out the garbage of the past and trying to keep at bay any new garbage that I, you know, because I'm still a very defectual person, and I have a lot of the same character that I had walking in the doors. But my defects have become my assets. I'm an extremely loyal person. I used to be so loyal that, you know, you couldn't peel me off your leg if I was, if the relationship wasn't over yet. I'm hanging on as you're walking down the street. You know, I am loyal Leo to a fault. And I learned that loyalty is a wonderful thing, but not when it hurts me. My second sponsor, Ginny, somebody who Clara knows very well, said to me, "You remind me of the girl with the turd." And I said, "Well, thank you very much. What is this story?" And she said, "Well, there was this girl at our meeting. She was a little crazy, and she walked around with her hands in her pocket all the time, this one hand. And when she'd take her hand, I mean, she wouldn't let anybody see. She'd put it in her pocket, or she'd hold it, you know, and cradle it. And one day, she trusted a couple of us women enough to look in her hand, and she was holding an old, dried-up turd. She reminded me of that girl." I said, "Well, thank you very much, you know." And I looked at her, and on all my loyalty, I said, "I know, but it was my turd. It belonged to me, you know." And that's the way it was. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to loosen my grip, how to let you see what I'm hanging on to, how to let go. I found out I'm just the link in the chain called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's my job to keep my link strong. You know, I formed that link by working the steps, and I have a sponsor, and I sponsor. And it's my job to be a good example to my family, because maybe I'll be the only example they ever see. They used to pull that on me all the time. Maybe you'll be the only example they ever see of Alcoholics Anonymous, so go be a good one. I became a worker among workers. I learned how to work a job and not tell them how I felt when they asked, because they really don't care, and we confuse them, you know. We spin this big web of story, and they just kind of walk away with their eyes glazed, like, "I'm never going to ask her how she is again," you know. And when you're a waitress, people don't want to hear it, you know. They just want good service. And so I learned how to do that, and I learned how to show up on time and give a little extra effort. And I've gotten better jobs and better jobs and better jobs. And you know, I've been in a corporate law firm for, gosh, 13 years this month. And they can count on me, and they trust me, and they know that, you know, I'm in the area of finance, and so they know they can trust me with their money. But they know nothing about me, really. They just know they get the example of Alcoholics Anonymous. They get the end result of what we do together. Chuck used to talk about it rains on the just and the unjust, and who am I? Who am I to say you get it, you don't get it? You know, we were talking about traffic, too. It's like, okay, somebody's there, they want to get in. It's not like, well, do you deserve it? Do I let you in because you're a good person? Or I don't like your attitude, you stay. You know, I mean, it's just like, just be part of the force for good, Sharon, and quit worrying about it, who gets and who doesn't get. And it's made me much more comfortable being one of God's kids and knowing that that's all you are, too, one of God's kids. And I looked for years for my purpose, and it says on page 77 that my purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to the God and the people about me. That was it. I had looked for a lot of years, and I have found my purpose, and that's it. And it takes a lot of work to do that for me, because I still have a loud head that wakes me up, and it's ready to go because it's been fed, you know. It's like a vulture sitting on the end of my bed ready to pick. But I've learned how to put my feet on the ground and show up. I have learned, in my first year, I used to say, "I'm not feeling well." She said, "Buy a thermometer. If you have a fever, you stay home. But if you don't have a fever, you show up. And then if you're still sick, maybe we'll send you home. But don't think about how you feel. You show up. And you get a commitment. And get a commitment somebody will miss, like coffee or cookies. So you have to show up." So I got cookies. And I remember making Ohio Street. I made these big peace signs with my cookies. And I would spend hours at the grocery store hyperventilating, because I couldn't do grocery stores for a long time. And okay, let's see, now Clint likes Oreos, and you know, Marianne likes Fig Newtons, and I only have so much money, and I mean, those people must have thought, all she's doing is buying a bag of cookies, but I would be there an hour, just trying to please everybody, and then I'd make these big displays of peace signs and all the right cookies, and they would come along and just grab them and not even look at them like they could care, and you know, one night I spilled some coffee on Clint in error, and he just screamed at me, and I thought, oh, screw all you guys. And I was on my way to get a bottle of vodka. Yeah, you guys talk big, but when it comes down to it, you know, how do you act? Well, I spilled coffee on him. That was his reaction. And I ran smack into a guy in my home group, just turned the corner to go to that drugstore to buy a bottle, and I ran smack into Duke. And he could see that wild look in my eyes, and he sat and took me to a coffee shop. And those are the kind of people that I'm around still to this day. They didn't say to me, yeah, there, dear, we know you're hurting, but we'll see you here next week, so hang in there. You know, they picked me up, they dropped me off, they gave me their best. I had this wired jaw for 3 months. I couldn't talk. I had to learn to listen in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a total blessing. A man named Chuck walked up to me and he said, you look tired, kid. I hope that you stay. Take your pack off and stay with us for 30 days. He turned around, walked away, and then he thought about it, came back to me, said, you look really tired. Why don't you stay with us for 90 days? I thought he was just the smartest man in the world. How does he know I'm so tired? He's the same old-timer that saw me making a list when somebody had given me some money. I had a list of rides, money, clothes, anything nice you had done for me, because I'm a scorekeeper, and I don't want to owe you anything because I want to pick up my pack and walk out of here clean. And he saw my list, and he went, well, you know, someday you're going to have a car, and you're going to be able to give someone a ride. You might even have a couch, and someone can sleep on it. You might have an extra $20 you can slip into that newcomer's purse because you know she needs it. That's the way we want to be paid back, Sharon. You don't pay these people back. You pass it on. We trust you that you can pass it on. And he gave me back some dignity. Despite that loving action of seeing what I was writing down, how I was so intense with all of this. And the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous have done that for me. They have taken the time to stop and tell me the truth. Now, you know, after being married and getting better jobs and having a baby and sponsoring people and walking through a lot of life, 10 years of sobriety, my husband decided he wanted the woman across the room who was new. And nobody got custody of the meeting, and my sponsor of 5 years went to Paris and smoked some pot and came back and had to raise her hand. I was just at wit's end. I was insane. I ended up at Clancy's door with my baby in a stroller, and I knocked and I said something like, I don't know if you like me and I don't know if I like you, but I need help. And he said, come in and sit down. And we've been trying it for 14 years ever since then. And the old timers would tell me the truth, though. I was angry and mad and upset that year. And, you know, they got pregnant, they got married. It was just like, ugh. I would do things like I dyed my hair and spiked it up, and I'd wear, you know, T-shirts that said not nice things on them, and I'd sit in the front row, and I'd kick out my legs when you'd walk by, and I'd fold my arms, and one day this lady named Pat walked by me, and it's the same lady that when I had a broken jaw, she took me to coffee, and she was talking to somebody, and I guess I was dripping coffee from the right side of my face where I had no feeling. Instead of making a big deal about it, she picked up a napkin, looked at me, and just wiped it off and went back to her conversation. She gave me a very loving act, and I'll never forget the kindness she showed me. And now I'm 10 years sober, and Pat's around, and she's now an old-timer. She walks by me, and she goes, look at Sharon. She's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got? And she kept on walking. So I had to go home and pray for her for a while. But I heard her. And shortly after that, I was on my way to baptize the two of them with some hot coffee, him and her. They seemed all happy in the back of the room, and I was on my way. And my sponsor happened to be at that meeting, and he saw where I was headed, and he saw the look in my eyes. I wasn't sleeping, I wasn't eating, I was crazed, but I was coming to meetings. No one's getting my seat. Oh, and I was sponsoring all the wacky ones, all the sane ones left at that time, and I was getting these newcomers with spinning eyes, and I remember throwing them into a car and going, we're going to a meeting. Sure, want to come? Yeah, sure. I'd throw them in the car, and I'd drive to Sacramento to a meeting from Los Angeles, and they'd want to stop and pee, and I'd go, hold it. You know, I was just so angry. And I was on my way with these two hot cups of coffee. I'm 10 years sober. I'm a spiritual giant by now, right? And he sees what's happening. He takes the coffee out of my hands. He puts it on the table, and he squares me off with his hands on my shoulder, and he gets my attention. He says, Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace. Well, you know, screw dignity and screw grace. That's what I want, revenge, you know. But he said words louder than my head. He said, so you can be an example to others. Ooh, what didn't want to hear truth, and I didn't want to hear him, and I knew he was right, and just in that instant, I had to give it up. I had to work my steps. I had to leave them alone. You know, they got married and had this baby, and they walked into, you know, holy sunset or something, but you know, I had to worry about me and my babies and my son and my job. I had to go get a better job, and I had to support my child, and I had to get back to meetings and shut my mouth and start praying again. You know, I had to start, I wrapped myself in blankets and sat on the heater and wrote my inventory and read it to my sponsor, and we got to start over again. Thank God we don't have to graduate here. And I didn't drink, and I came to a lot of meetings, and I slowly got better, and I was sponsoring this nun. I know, it's a little far-fetched, but I still sponsor Sheila to this day, and I get to tell her daily, don't worry, Sheila, have faith, it's going to turn out, you know. And I was sponsoring this nun, waiting for her mass. She would say, okay, I'll meet you after mass, and so I wait to go have dinner, and this healing happened. And I thought, huh, this healing happened. It was 1 year, 1 month, and 18 days later, but who's counting? And I got to walk into a brand new view. And I realized later on, because, you know, I don't realize things at the time. I do know if I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired today. Most of those circuits have been put back together. But much of my lessons have been looking at life backwards. And I realized that it was just a hallway. I'm the one whining all the way through this wonderful growth process so I can leave the view I had in God's mansion, and I get to go through the hallway, 1 year, 1 month, and 18 days in the hallway. The new door opens, and I have a beautiful new room in God's mansion with a beautiful new view I've never seen before. So quit whining in the hallways. Ask the person next to you why they're there. Listen to their sad story for a while. Hang some art. Play some music. Open a window. Know that your turn will come if you stick in the hallway. You know, if you drink, you're out of the mansion. So I've learned how to enjoy growth. It's just called growth. And I've learned how to put that over me like a loose garment. This has been a year of a lot of letting go this last year. And it's been easier because I have more experience. I've walked through more experience sober. I have more faith, and I know it's going to be okay. Because I know, because I'm an alcoholic, I got to know the payoff, you know. The payoff is a new view, always, when I get through some growth and I don't run from it. I go through it. I want to let you know that, you know, Jill and I became best friends, this woman who had my ex-husband's second child in life. And he was a little boy, and so the boys want to play together because I have a son. I have a great kid. He's going to be 16 this month. I can't believe it. He looked at me a couple of years ago, and he said, God, Mom, you wasted a lot of time drinking, didn't you? I was like, where'd he get that one? He went to his first prom a couple of weeks ago, and they were all going to a rave, and he just went, oh, Mom, those raves are so tired. You know, they went out and they plopped down credit cards at the Bonaventure and watched movies all night. You know, it's just like he came home bright-eyed and wanted to tell me all about the evening. I thought, God, where did this one come from, you know? And he does things like, you know, he'll cheer up my babies on the phone if they get him when he calls, you know. He's got a great sense of humor. But Jill and I got to be good friends, and, you know, it's an amazing thing. We have this meeting every Wednesday night. It's about 1,000 people, and there's, I don't know, 400 people with commitments, and we're just having a new secretary, so we're having the changing of the guard. And once again, Jill is my crew chief. She's always my boss at that meeting for commitments, so... You know, she's my boss again. I have to listen to, you know, my ex-husband's wife, but now she's his second ex-wife, so we've been better friends for a while. It's worked out that way. He married an Al-Anon, moved to Lake Arrowhead. He's fine. But a couple of years ago, I went home. I go home every year with my parents, and... My dad and I, you know, we had a long ways to go, and something that Ginny did for me was one night when I was having a fight with my husband, she said, why don't you call your father and ask him to pay him back the money you owe him? And I thought, well, how does she know about the money I owe him? I didn't talk to her about this. And, you know, they go to sponsor school, and they have this checklist, you know. So I called my dad, and my dad had been out to my wedding, had been to a meeting, had looked at all of you and said, Sharon, look at what look at your life. Look what you got. You got it made. If you think about doing what you were doing before, think twice. So my father said to me after my wedding when I was 2.5 years sober. And so now I'm 7 years sober, 5, 6 years sober, and I started with the sponsor making these financial amends. I called my father and I said, well, I think it's time, Dad, that maybe I make these financial amends. I need you to give me a total. And I know that I just mentioned a few things like the car and the bail bondsman. I didn't go into a lot of stuff. And he said, okay, Sharon, it's this much. And he gave me a figure. He was ready for me. He had gone home. He had read the big book. He had run a calculator tape. He had put it on page 78, I think, where it says, or 79, most alcoholics owe money. And I know he said to my mother, look, if Sharon calls me, I'm not home. Here it is. And if she stays sober, she'll get to this part of the big book. So it's circled in red right here. You know, I know my dad. I know my dad. So I was resentful because I thought it was too high and he was too fast. So I called my sponsor and she yawned into the phone and she said, well, what can you pay him every month? And so in 2 days I called him back and he didn't amend the amount. He just accepted my terms. And so she said, okay, then we get started. You may be the only example your dad sees of the big book, so make it a good one. Do not be late with that check to your father. And she said, no, are you really willing to grow through this amends? Are you really willing to try to heal this with your dad? Well, you've got me backed in the corner. I can't move. What am I supposed to say? No. You know, I mean, a good sponsor will wait until a baby's right in the corner, and then they'll ask just that little bit more, and that's what she did. And thank God she did, because she wanted more for me than I wanted for myself. She said, I want you to put a letter or a note with that to your dad. Don't send the cold check. Just put a note about your life. And I complained because he's got 3 other professional children he can talk about life with. What does he want the nut in California in AA for? And she listened for a moment, and then she said, do it anyway. So I did it anyway, and I sent that note and that check every month on time. The letter, maybe I sent a letter, a one-page letter. Maybe I sent a card. Dad's Day was easier to pick up. Father's Day cards as this went on. I remembered his birthday on time. It seemed like the 3-way conversations between my dad, my mom, and me got a little easier. I could talk to him a little bit longer on the phone, just him and me. And it was about 4 years of me doing this, checking this note on time every month, because I may be the only example in action of the book Alcoholics Anonymous that my father ever sees. That he called me himself and said, Merry Christmas. It was between Christmas and New Year's. And he said, I don't want your money anymore. Your debt is free and clear. And I got off light, about 2 years light. And he added the words that made all the difference because of my sponsor who wanted more from me. He said, don't stop sending me your notes, Sharon. And my dad and I got to walk into a brand new relationship, healed and guilt-free. Healed and guilt-free. My father and I could not sit at the same table. We couldn't ride in the same car. There was so much pain between me and Dad. Never anything physical, just emotional, spiritual pain. And I got to be his little girl again. I got to be his buddy again. I got to go home and spend time with him when I went home in his garden or in the hardware store or driving somewhere with him or doing an errand or just sitting and talking. And a couple years ago, my dad came out and started to talk to me one night. It was the 4th of July, and it was a perfect day, a perfect 4th of July, perfect fireworks, perfect picnic, perfect. And the fireflies were out, and I was sweeping up after we had done some sparklers, and my dad came out and started sharing with me how hard it was to get older. And my first thought was, oh, good, I can be your spiritual sponsor, you know. But louder than my head was a voice, which was my God, said, just shut up and listen. And so I got to really listen to my dad share with me. What an honor. And my dad was killed a year ago, April 19th. And when I got that call, I was able to go home and be of service without the guilt. Just to go home and be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous and be of service to my mother, who had been married to my father almost 58 years. And to go home and be a member of that family and be available emotionally and physically and spiritually. What a gift. And I was able to give my dad my chip and a note before they put him in the ground. And I got to play him an accordion number, too. Because they had the wake, and I thought, oh, I can't talk. This is going to be too emotional. But my son got up and talked, and I thought, oh, he gets up and talk. I got to get up. And so I did, but I was able to I was able to play my dad Amazing Grace on his accordion. And it's funny how we always think it's about us, you know. About halfway through this wake, as everybody's coming through the line, because it was an accident, it was quick, my father wasn't sick, and the town showed up for my dad. And we were all home, and we all live in different parts of the country, all of us kids. And, you know, about the eighth time that, you know, Mrs. Dullegill said to me, "Now, are you Nancy or Sharon?" You know, I just thought, I can't do this anymore. And it became about me, not my father's wake. And self-centeredness of the alcoholic. I ended up at the rectory on the telephone calling Clancy at the Midnight Mission. And he didn't answer. I was on hold. And I hung up and I thought, all right, I'm going to call back one more time and he's got 60 seconds. And I answered. Omar speaking. I said, may I talk to Clancy? And he puts me on hold before I can say, it's long distance. On 48, he picked up. 48 seconds, he picked up. So I told him about, you know, and he's listening very patiently. You know, it's 2 hours earlier, he's still at work, and he's listening at the end of his day. He said, okay. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I worked on this accordion thing all day long for my dad, and it's his accordion, and it's a button accordion. I haven't played in years, but I'm going to do this. And Clancy said, oh, my God, Sharon, there won't be a dry eye on the place. The whole church people will just be crying. And I'm thinking, yeah, all right, he's coming in with me, you know, he's coming along with me. And they said, you know what, Sharon, but really watch for the ones sobbing, because they will be the musicians, you know. Oh, that's right, this isn't about me, it's my father's wake, you know. Thank God I have a sponsor louder than my head. I want to let you know that I got to make amends for that carnival, because I sponsor a nun and an ex-nun. So the nun I sponsor has a Catholic school where my son went to school, and they have a carnival every year, and I got to work it and buy ride tickets for the kids every single year. So I did that for 8 years and got to make my amends to the carnival. So if you think there's ways not to make amends, be willing. It will appear for you. And Steve was talking about sponsorship last night, and the one that used to eat the carrots on the phone to me. Marcel met Beth in Hawaii, and she was a snotty little high-rise Santa Monica princess, and she had vodka stains on her big book, and she knew everything, and she was drunk at a meeting one more time. And I tried to tie her shoes because she kept tripping over her tennis shoe laces, and she kicked me away, and then she called me and asked me to be her sponsor, and I thought, oh, God, why me? You know, and she wanted to run a marathon for her year. And so we took her out to Upland so she could run this marathon. And, you know, and I made sure she tied those shoes, and I double-tied them, you know. And she let me. And she's out there, and she's not coming in. And it's dark, and where's Beth? And all of a sudden, way down there, we see this little girl coming. And I look at her, and her shoes are still tied. You know, they're still tied. And she's coming across the finish line, and she's just got that look of spirit and God and love and worth in her eyes. And I was about 4 years sober, and I got to stand right next to it. You know, I love to be right next to the miracle of God working in your life. I need God with skin on. You know, Beacons was my first God. Beacons, the moving van company. It's a long story, but it was. Today, when I see Beacons, I still feel better. It works still. But I've gotten to take my God in my heart and keep it clean and keep my intuition going with you, and to be part of this miracle right next to it. And I feel from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes like God's kids. I know my purpose. I know what I am to do in life. I am to suit up and show up and be the best I can be to try to help you get done what you need to get done, and to let you help me. I am not so independent that I don't need you anymore. I need you very much. A lady named Mary Regan, who is a great in our area, has gone off to the big meeting in the sky too. Used to talk about her animals. I've made my amends to the animal kingdom. I have this great little dog, and that's my. This dog is my. My morning meditation. You know, she sticks her face in the bed and goes, okay, it's a new day, let's go, I love you, you're great, I think you're wonderful, let's go for a walk, you know. And so we get out there and we go for a walk, and, you know, most of the time that's my prayer. It's very simple. God, please help me to be half the person that my dog thinks I am. Now, it's pretty darn simple. And I want to tell you, a couple of years ago, I got to go back to Washington, D.C., and I got to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Congressional Breakfast. And I got to stand up and represent the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to make amends to that town. The circles close and the spiral just keeps going on up and the views get more beautiful. So I hope that you know that you are a link in the chain called Alcoholics Anonymous. What we have here is something very tradition-based. One alcoholic talking to another. It's that simple. I drive a nice car, but it's not so nice that if I have to pick up a newcomer and they want to puke in it, they can puke in it. You know, I don't want to forget where I came from. And I hope that I can become half the person that my dog thinks I am on a good day. And I want to thank you for having me.